From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Mr. El-Masri needs three things. The first thing is that the American government has to confirm what they have done to him. The second, what he's interested in, is that they do explain why this happened to him. And the third thing is now, because we know now that he's innocent, that they do an apology to him. Apologize.
Prosecutors in Germany issue arrest warrants for 13 CIA operatives linked to the kidnapping and torture of a German citizen, Khaled al-Masri, 3 years ago. We'll look at his case and the case of Maher Arar with Frederick Hitz, the former inspector general of the CIA. He wants to publicize the case of Maher Arar being deported to Syria, where he was tortured, to end the government's practice of extraordinary rendition in this country. Then Venezuela's National Assembly approves President Hugo Chavez's request to rule by decree. We'll host a debate. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The world's leading body of climate scientists has concluded global warming is very likely caused by human activity and may be impossible to stop. In its strongest language to date, the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Environmental Climate Change predicts melting glaciers, rising temperatures, and higher sea levels. This is IPCC Chair Rajendra Pachauri.
I only want to draw your attention to the fact that we are, and if you look at the language of the summary for policymakers, you'll be able to read this, we are, in a sense, doing things that perhaps have not happened in 650,000 years.
For the first time, the panel also said global warming has been the likely cause of increased hurricane and cyclone activity over the last 30 years. IPCC Working Group co-chair Susan Solomon warned of more unexpected changes if current trends continue.
If we were to keep emitting greenhouse gases at or above the current rates, that would cause further warming and induce many changes in the global system, the global climate system, that would very likely be larger in the 21st century than they were in the 20th century.
Although the climate change report is the gloomiest on record, it's already being criticized for not going far enough. The panel was said to have initially reached a consensus of 99% certainty on human activities linked to global warming, but it reduced the assessment to 90%. Under reported pressure from China. Several scientists have also warned the IPCC's warning on sea levels could be outdated and too optimistic. Opponents of global warming science had their own response. The American Enterprise Institute is now offering scientists and economists $10,000 to write articles undermining the UN climate change report. The American Enterprise Institute's offer came as one of its major backers, the oil giant ExxonMobil, announced another record year for its bottom line. On Thursday, ExxonMobil posted an annual profit of $39.5 billion for 2006. That's the most ever by a U.S. company, beating Exxon's own record from 2005. In Iraq, at least 60 people were killed in a double suicide bombing in the town of Hilla Thursday. Another 150 were wounded. Meanwhile, a new study shows the troop surge in Iraq could actually be double the size initially claimed. The Congressional Budget Office says the real troop increase could be as high as 48,000. The estimates based on the Pentagon's policy of sending additional support units alongside regular combat troops. At least 15,000 support troops would have to be sent alongside the 21,000 shipping off to Iraq. The same study also estimates the escalation could cost up to $27 billion in its first year, nearly nine times the projected estimate. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, General George Casey received unexpected criticism Thursday during his confirmation hearings to become chief of staff. Casey's led the Iraq War for the past 3 years. In a hearing of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Republican Senator John McCain told Casey he's made overly optimistic predictions while implementing a failed strategy in Iraq.
And while I do not in any way question your honor, your patriotism, or your service to our country, I do question some of the decisions and judgments you've made over the past 2.5 years as commander of multinational forces in Iraq. During that time, Things have gotten markedly and progressively worse, and the situation in Iraq can now best be described as dire and deteriorating. I regret that our window of opportunity to reverse momentum may be closing.
In the occupied territories, at least 10 people have been killed in renewed fighting between the Palestinian factions Fatah and Hamas. More than 100 people have been injured since the breakdown of a truce that lasted just 3 days. Back in the United States, the Senate's approved a bill that would raise the minimum wage for the first time in a decade. The measure matches the $2.10 increase already approved by the House, but adds new tax breaks for business demanded by the White House. It could be a while before a final bill clears both chambers. House Democrats have said they oppose linking the minimum wage increase to tax cuts. In other congressional news, Democratic House Judiciary Committee Chair John Conyers has announced plans to investigate President Bush's use of signing statements through which he claims a right to ignore or not enforce sections of bills that he signs into law. Conyers says the investigation will focus on around 150 of the signing statements Bush has signed into law. Since taking office, the president has issued over 800 signing statements, more than all other presidents combined. The U.S. government has lost a major deportation case that dates back to the Reagan administration. A federal immigration judge has dismissed efforts to deport two Palestinian Americans for their actions 20 years ago when they allegedly raised money for the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. In 1987, the Reagan administration attempted to bar the two men, Khadr Hamid and Michel Shehadeh, and six others, on the grounds they were connected to a communist group. The men became known as the L.A. Eight. They were never deported because a federal appeals court declared the anti-communist law to be unconstitutional. In a scathing ruling made public this week, Judge Bruce Einhorn of Los Angeles said the government violated the defendant's constitutional rights in a case he called, quote, an embarrassment to the rule of law. Speaking to the Los Angeles Times, Hamid said, quote, the government spent millions of dollars and thousands of hours trying to deport us, and the only thing they ever accused us of were constitutionally protected activity. In another major legal defeat for the Bush administration, two men were acquitted Thursday of belonging to the Palestinian group Hamas and supporting terror attacks within the U.S. The defendants, Abdel Halim Ashkar and Mohammed Salah, were charged in a case that has drawn attention over its reliance on Israeli intelligence. Chicago prosecutors called Israeli intelligence agents to the stand and submitted statements Salah made under Israeli interrogation. Defense lawyers claimed those statements were coerced. In Florida, Governor Charlie Crist has announced the state will abandon touchscreen voting machines in favor of paper ballots. The $30 million replacement would mark the nation's biggest rejection of voting machines to date. Senator Joseph Biden spent his first day as a Democratic presidential candidate Thursday apologizing for remarks about fellow senator and presidential hopeful Barack Obama. Biden ignited controversy after calling Obama, quote, the first mainstream African-American who is articulate and bright and clean and a nice-looking guy. Biden appeared on the radio program of Reverend Al Sharpton. Sharpton told Biden, quote, a lot of people took it from you that because Obama is Harvard trained, people don't see someone as good and clean unless they are less connected to the struggle of the African-American community. And finally, lawmakers in South Dakota have introduced a new attempt to ban abortion. The Women's Health and Human Life Protection Act would permit abortion only to prevent the death of a woman. Victims of rape or incest would be allowed abortion under several restrictions. They would have to report the rape within 50 days, submit blood samples to law enforcement, obtain records for physicians, and provide the name and address of the alleged rapist. The new measure comes 3 months after South Dakota voters rejected an abortion ban on the midterm ballot. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now! John Fahey here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we look at the case of Ali Al-Mari. Over 5 years ago, he was arrested at his home in Peoria, Illinois, where he lived with his wife and five children. He was initially arrested on criminal charges and suspicion of being part of a sleeper al-Qaeda cell. But in June 2003, President Bush declared him to be an enemy combatant. The criminal charges were dropped. He was handed over to the military. He's been held in solitary confinement ever since in a Navy brig in South Carolina. He's the only person still being held as an enemy combatant on U.S. soil. Al-Mari has not been charged with any crime. Evidence has never been presented, and the Bush administration is claiming the right to jail him forever without pressing charges. On Thursday, Al-Mari's attorneys appeared in a federal court in Richmond, Virginia, to fight his detention. The case marks one of the first challenges of the Military Commission Act and its suspension of the writ of habeas corpus. 2 months ago, 30 constitutional scholars filed a brief about Al-Mari's case. They warned if the government prevails, it would expose more than 20 million non-citizens residing in the United States to the risk of indefinite detention on the basis of unfounded rumors, mistaken identity, and lies. Here with me now is one of Al-Mari's attorneys, Jonathan Hafitz, an attorney with the Brennan Center for Justice here in New York City. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi, good morning.
So, start from the beginning. How was Al-Mari picked up?
Well, he was arrested at his home by FBI agents, charged with a crime, and then, as you pointed out, shortly before trial, and actually literally on the eve of a hearing to suppress illegally seized evidence that was taken from his home without a warrant, the government essentially just pulled the plug on the criminal justice system and, by the stroke of a pen, transferred him to a military brig, to legal limbo, where he had no rights, was held incommunicado, and has been detained without charges now for going on 4 years.
What is this brig where he is held?
Well, the brig is a military prison in South Carolina. It's typically houses individuals from the military who are convicted, court-martialed for offenses. But he's in a isolated wing of the brig. He's never seen another prisoner. The only individuals he's permitted to see are his captors, the military guards, and now his lawyers are able to see him. But the first 17 months, he was held completely incommunicado. His lawyers were not able to contact him. We had no contact with him.
For how long?
For 17 months.
Almost a year and a half.
That's correct. Even the International Committee for the Red Cross was not able to go in. I mean, it was essentially secret detention on U.S. soil. We had no way of knowing if he was alive.
And what exactly was the charge?
Well, there was no charge. There were just allegations made, hearsay allegations we believe that were obtained from detainees through illegal methods, other detainees, possibly through torture. The government did not present in court. There's been no hearing, no witnesses, nothing that would resemble what we understand as due process.
And explain what you mean when on the eve of trial?
Well, the trial was a few weeks away, but the judge had scheduled a hearing to suppress illegally seized evidence. The government can't present evidence at a trial that's been taken from someone's home without a warrant. And there was a hearing to find out whether that had happened. And instead of going forward with the hearing, as would normally happen, the government showed up with an order, a one-page order from the president saying, you're an enemy combatant, we're going to dismiss the criminal case, and we're going to snatch Mr. Al-Mari and put him in a brig.
And what does enemy combatant mean? That he had been fighting on the battlefield?
Well, the term enemy combatant means essentially whatever the government says it means. They've used different definitions in different cases.
Invented by this administration?
The concept of enemy combatant is not a concept that's identified under the laws of war. The government claims it's a customary use of the laws of war law of armed conflict, but there is no such thing as an enemy combatant, as the administration's used its term. The way they use it is they try to describe it as someone who's fighting on a battlefield, but Mr. Al-Mari was never on a battlefield, never fought against U.S. troops. He's not in any way what we understand to be a combatant under the laws of war. He's essentially an alleged criminal who should be tried in the criminal justice system and has a right to be tried, but they're inventing this term to try to kind of pull the rug from under those rights and kind of get out of the Bill of Rights.
And so he's held in the military brig for how long?
Well, he's been at the brig now for over 3.5 years.
And how does this fit into the Military Commissions Act?
Well, while his case was on appeal, Congress passed the Military Commissions Act in October, last October. And what the government has come to court claiming is that the Military Commissions Act strips the courts of the power even to hear his habeas corpus case. So if the government's correct, the court would not even have the power to decide whether his detention is lawful. We submit that that was never Congress's intention. It never suspended the writ of habeas corpus, and so it could never eliminate the right of habeas corpus for any of the lawful resident aliens in the United States who have constitutional rights just like American citizens. And, if they did, it would be unconstitutional. Congress could not take away the court's power to hear his habeas case.
Janet Reno, the former attorney general, mm-hmm. has commented on this case. What has she said?
Well, what she said, I think, is very important, which is she and other top law enforcement officials who've spent their careers prosecuting crimes, including, alleged terrorist crimes. And they say, look, the nation's criminal laws are very strong and are sufficient to handle the prosecution of terrorism cases. And we've seen that before 9/11, and we've seen it after. The government has prosecuted and obtained numerous convictions of individuals alleged of things that are similar to what is alleged against Mr. Omari. And what we're asking for is that same right, that same core right of our Constitution to be able to contest the charges and prove his innocence at a criminal trial.
So what does this mean for other non-citizens in the United States?
Well, it's, I think, very, very terrifying what it could mean. It means, one, if the government is correct about the Military Commissions Act, any immigrant could be snatched off the streets and secretly jailed, potentially forever, in a military brig without ever having the right to get to court on a habeas corpus petition, to ever have a right to receive judicial review of whether their detention is unlawful. And it means that individuals could be held potentially forever without charge. And it's important to note that the powers the government is asserting to hold Mr. Omari as an enemy combatant are the same powers they say they can hold a U.S. citizen. They've made clear that if everything were the same and Mr. Omari were a U.S. citizen, they could do exactly the same thing. So what can happen to him could happen to U.S. citizen. It happened to Jose Padilla, as we know. And, this is it. They are essentially crossing the Rubicon. They are essentially saying, we don't have to follow the criminal justice system and the Bill of Rights if we deem someone an enemy combatant.
So what happens now? Well, in Omari's case.
Well, we will wait for the Fourth Circuit's decision in his appeal.
And he remains in the brig.
He remains in the brig pending a decision.
And the Congress, Senate passing the Military Commissions Act, stripping habeas corpus?
Well, the court will decide whether Congress, in fact, stripped habeas corpus over his case. And if it did, it will address whether or not it's constitutional. So the court will address that issue in its decision.
What have you met with Omari?
Yes, a number of times.
What is his mental condition?
Well, I think it's fluctuated over time. It's at times it's been very bad. I mean, there was a period of time when he was held in the isolation and the deprivation of basic necessities, basic religious items that didn't allow him to practice Islam. Things like, that we take for granted, like soap and toilet paper, were not given to him. And there were a period of time where he was felt like he was, losing his mind. He's, now in more stable conditions. Things have improved, largely because we filed a lawsuit against the government to compel them to treat him humanely. But he's, I think, been harmed very significantly, physically and mentally, by this ordeal. But, he's trying to hold it together and to maintain faith that he'll have the right to a fair hearing in court one day.
And what about his family, his wife and his kids?
Well, it's difficult. His youngest child, for example, he last saw when he was nine. The child was 9 months old, now over five, has not seen them. He's not allowed to talk to them on the phone, no visits. All he's allowed to communicate through is letters. But because of the government censorship, they take sometimes 10 months to reach his family, or there's family's letters to reach him, and they're sometimes very redacted. They'll black out, 3/4 of a letter from a 7-year-old child. So it's really inconceivable that he's not allowed to have meaningful contact with his own family.
And what circumstances, under what circumstances do you see him? What is the physical space like? What condition is he in?
Well, now we see him, it varies. I mean, we were able to sit, across from him. He's now not restrained. He used to have a leg shackle when we ankle shackle on, but we're able to meet with him now. And the staff at the brig have been very professional and accommodating in handling these requests. And the problem is not with the folks at the brig, the military people. The problem is with the administration and the three stars, as it were, who set this kind of policy where you can hold someone as an enemy combatant and not give him any of the protections that we give prisoners during wartime.
Jonathan Hafetz, I want to thank you very much for being with us. He's Associate Counsel of the Liberty and National Security Project at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Thanks.
John Fahey here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM and college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also there in Spanish, and any radio station can take those headlines in audio form. As we turn now to German prosecutors who've issued arrest warrants for 13 CIA operatives linked to the kidnapping and torture of a German citizen 3 years ago. The man is named Khaled Al-Masri. He was seized in Macedonia, then flown on a CIA jet to a secret U.S. jail in Afghanistan. He was held for 5 months, tortured, and then released. The arrest warrants for the CIA agents were announced at a time that the U.S. practice known as extraordinary rendition is coming under increasing scrutiny around the globe. In Italy, another 26 CIA agents faced prosecution for their role in the abduction of the Egyptian cleric Abu Omar off the streets of Milan. In Spain, a judge ruled Thursday for the state's intelligence agency to declassify any documents it has about secret CIA flights. Meanwhile, the Canadian government agreed last week to pay over $9 million to Maher Arar. He is the Canadian citizen who was seized by U.S. officials at Kennedy Airport in New York City in 2002, then sent to a Syrian jail where he was tortured. Khaled Al-Masri, Abu Omar, Maher Arar were all seized as part of the secretive U.S. program known as Extraordinary Rendition. Al-Masri and Arar tried to sue the CIA in federal court, but their cases were dismissed on grounds they would reveal state secrets. Earlier this week, Al-Masri's lawyer, Manfred Jindzic, called for accountability.
Mr. El-Masri needs three things. The first thing is that the American government has to confirm what they have done to him. The second, what he's interested in, is that they do explain why this happened to him. And the third thing is now, because we know now that he's innocent, that they do an apology to him.
The Bush administration's refused to admit that U.S. agents were involved in El-Masri's abduction. On Wednesday, State Department spokesperson Sean McCormick was questioned about the arrest warrants.
But I would just reiterate just very simply what the Secretary has said many times over on issues of this type, and that is that we respect the sovereignty of our friends and allies. And that we have a very good relationship with Germany. We have a very good relationship with Germany working on counterterrorism and counterintelligence operations.
Joining me now from Toronto is British journalist Stephen Gray. He helped expose the secret rendition program back in 2004. He's the author of the new book, Ghost Plane, the true story of the CIA torture program. Welcome, Stephen Gray. Your response to these latest developments?
I think it's an amazing turning point, really. We've now got a very, very serious prosecutor in Germany filing criminal charges, declaring, you know, the German state is effectively declaring now that a major CIA program is a criminal activity. I mean, we've now got the three biggest centers of prosecution in Europe, Milan, Munich, and Madrid. The three places which have done the most, really, to pursue terrorists, to investigate al-Qaeda across Europe, are now turning their attention to the CIA and believing that, in the belief that in pursuit of terrorism, you have to abide by the rule of law. And it's going to place, I think, great pressure on the United States to also examine whether this program has followed the law.
Explain what happened in the case of Khaled El-Masri.
Well, El-Masri was picked up in Macedonia. That's in Eastern Europe. He was snatched on the border there, held in a hotel, and then picked up by a CIA team wearing black ski masks and flown in a corporate jet, a large corporate jet, to Afghanistan, where he was held in secret in a secret jail for 5 months without charge. And he was finally released after going on hunger strike. And then he was abandoned in the mountains of Albania before being released. It seemed an incredible story, but it's all been verified. And I think, as I mentioned to you before on this program, in the book I describe and identified the CIA team responsible because they visited a Spanish island of Mallorca, stayed in hotels there, enjoyed quite a lifestyle there, but they left behind a trail of evidence showing who was in this team. And it's these same people I identified, including the captain, a man by the name of James Faring, that's a false name, but that's the name he used. Five flight crew, four pilots and a mechanic, and the CIA team on board, the people who did the snatch, they're all part of this team of 13 people that have all now been issued with arrest warrants in Germany. So it's an astonishing development. And as I say, the people behind this arrest warrant, the federal prosecutors in Munich, Germany, are people you have to take very, very seriously.
We're going to come back to this case, but I want to turn now to Frederick Hitz. He served as Inspector General at the Central Intelligence Agency from 1990 to 1998 and is now a professor of law at the University of Virginia School of Law. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, and I could not hear Professor Gray. Was that your intention? I couldn't hear the feed.
No, I'm sorry that you couldn't hear him. He was talking about the case of Khaled El-Masri and what
right.
happened to him and the fact that German prosecutors now have issued arrest warrants for 13 CIA operatives.
I heard your lead-in, and the only thing that I think you have to establish is that it's an allegation by El-Masri that he was tortured. I think that has yet to be established, and the other elements of your factual discussion of it sounded correct, but
so
the torturing has yet to be established.
Right. Well, let's talk about this other case that you're very familiar with and that you want to make much more high profile in this country. And this is the case of Maher Arar.
Yeah.
Why don't you go through the facts as you understand them? And we've talked about this a lot on Democracy Now!, but this case of Maher Arar coming back from a family vacation in 2002 and transiting through Kennedy Airport, where he was picked up.
Right. He started in Tunisia. He had been in Tunisia. He flew to Zurich and was flying from Zurich to home to Toronto via Kennedy. And he was apprehended upon his getting down from the flight into Kennedy on the basis of information supplied by the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and Canadian intelligence officials that was erroneously exaggerated beyond what the Canadians actually knew about Mr. Arar. He was a person of interest, which is a technical term, based on some activity that had taken place in Canada prior to his departure for Tunisia, his friendship with another Canadian of Middle Eastern, of Syrian extraction, actually, named Al Malki. And this information was, it appears, exaggerated beyond, as I say, what the actual facts were to make it appear as if he were known al-Qaeda. And that is exactly what the administrative law, the immigration law judge concluded in New York City, that he was al-Qaeda based on this Canadian information, and he was then removed from the United States. That's the technical term. Flown, much as al-Masri was, flown by private jet to Amman, Jordan, and then taken by automobile to Damascus, Syria, where he was held by the Syrian authorities, questioned intensively, tortured for a week or two, and then held in a very small cell for nearly a year. The important points here are that the Canadian government apparently was not advised by American authorities that the United States was going to render him to Syria, remove him to Syria. The issue since his return has been, and I think also in the lead-in there was another factual point I wanted to correct, he has sued the United States. In addition to receiving this substantial settlement with the Canadian government, he has sued the United States, and that suit is ongoing. The issue is, did the United States have independent evidence, as it alleges, to Arar's activities that made, on a separate basis, that he was al-Qaeda? Now, and incisive report on this matter has been rendered by a high court justice in Canada named Dennis O'Connor. It's an excellent report, and it points to what transpired here, but the United States did not cooperate with his investigation. It did not send the officials who were involved to testify before his commission. So that's a black hole for him, too. But based on what he did know about what had taken place in Canada, he found that there was no basis for Arar to have been considered al-Qaeda. He was a person of interest because of some of his associations, but the conclusion had not been drawn, and that information should not have been transferred to American authorities.
Now, a very big event took place a few days ago where you have the Conservative Prime Minister of Canada, Stephen Harper, an ally of President Bush, apologizing publicly to Maher Arar when they announced the multimillion-dollar compensation to Maher Arar and criticizing the Bush administration for maintaining Maher Arar on a terrorist no-fly list in the United States.
That's right. I think, actually, the Prime Minister, you're quite right. He apologized to Mr. Arar. I think he felt disappointed that the United States did not clear him for travel to the United States, and it was really his Minister of Public Safety, Stockman Day, who had been supplied with some indication of what information the United States had that stated that he was disappointed in it. It didn't appear to be any different from what the Canadians had supplied, and therefore exaggerated, and he felt there was no basis for him to, that is, Arar, to be continued to be kept on this no-fly list.
Now, I mean, you're speaking from an interesting position, Frederick Hitz. You're the former inspector general at the CIA. How do people within the agency feel about this extraordinary term, extraordinary rendition, this practice?
This is that's an excellent question, and I feel very strongly about it. I believe that the CIA I know, the officers I know, do not favor extraordinary rendition. They know it's a mug's game. They know that there's no bottom to it, and they also know that, quite frankly, in the way these things play out, and it's beginning to go this way, they, the officers involved, the people in the field, those people who are being called to act in this matter, they're the ones that are going to pay the price. There's nobody in the chain of command that really will be held accountable for this based on past practice from Iran-Contra and other kinds of episodes. So in my view, I am against it. I'm against extraordinary rendition on a number of grounds, principally because of the immorality of it, the illegality of it, the fact that it doesn't work, didn't produce anything in this case. But very importantly from my past, because I fear that the CIA and the officers involved in this are going to be put through a long period of explanation and perhaps even some legal jeopardy as a consequence.
What about all of these cases, Frederick Hitz? And we're going to go back to Stephen Gray in a minute, but the German prosecutors issuing the arrest warrants for 13 CIA operatives involved in the case of Khaled al-Masri. Then you have the arrest warrants in Italy, another 26 CIA agents facing prosecution for their role in the abduction of the Egyptian cleric Abu Ammar off the streets of Milan.
I think you'll note that the authorities are saying it's not at all clear to them that the persons whom they have cited, whom they subpoenaed, will appear and will actually come into the legal proceeding to defend themselves. But they're making the point, and this, I think, is the essence of your question. They are making the point in the actions they've taken, the magistrate in Italy and now the German prosecutor, that they're not going to put up with this any longer. Secret prisons, extraordinary renditions are out as far as Europe is concerned. And insofar as they continue, if those incidents of extraordinary rendition come to the attention of European governments in future, you can expect the full panoply of legal tools to be used against them.
So what are you doing to publicize this? Yesterday you had a panel at the University of Virginia.
Yes. What's happened is that, as you perhaps know, the Canada Institute of the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., put on a program in Ottawa this past Monday, of which I was privileged to be a part, to discuss the excellent O'Connor report. And I would like to see if we can put on a similar program at the University of Virginia, either at the University of Virginia School of Law or through the Miller Center. I don't want to get ahead of myself here. I've discussed this matter with the individuals who could people in authority who could bring this about. But I would think it would be excellent if we could get Mr. Justice O'Connor to come down to the United States, come down to Charlottesville, and tell our audience about his report, what he found, and what its ramifications are.
Do you think you could get any Supreme Court justices to weigh in here, past or present?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
Do you think you could get any Supreme Court justices to weigh in here?
Well, I don't know, but I think your question's a good one. I think this is a matter that deserves some kind of rebroadcast, if you will, some kind of publicity in the United States, because I think many Americans, with all that's been going on in Iran and with the Democratic ascension to power in the Congress, have let the Arar matter just sort of slip by. And in the tradition of many previous Canadian official reports, this O'Connor report bears reading. It is extremely well drafted. It's like our 9/11 Commission report. The judge is not at all vindictive. He recognizes the very important point that Canada intelligence and law enforcement authorities have to cooperate in the fullest manner with their American counterparts on this terrorist issue, but mistakes were made and they have to be corrected and there has to be some accountability.
Frederick Hitz, I want to thank you very much for joining us and give the final word to Stephen Gray, who's joining us from Canada, a British journalist, to help expose the whole extraordinary rendition program, particularly tracing the planes. Frederick Hitz joining us from Virginia. There has been major developments in North Carolina, where North Carolina legislators are looking for an investigation into aero contractors, which is the one of the contractors that has been used by the CIA to fly these planes. Final comment on that, Stephen Gray. We're talking about CIA agents possibly being indicted. What about those that flew the torture flights?
Well, absolutely. But I mean, the CIA agents and the flight crew that took them, they're all going to be held accountable. But to some degree, these people are the witnesses who can provide evidence of who ordered these things. And I think the orders came from the very top. And those probably are the people who really should ultimately be facing legal scrutiny. As Mr. Hitz says, as you get closer to the front line, as you do in war, you find the CIA people who did these things are often the most skeptical about their value, and they know full well what happens when you send people to a country like Syria. And I think, regardless of the evidence that the CIA may have had against Meher Arar when he was sent to Syria, we all know intelligence reports often turn out to be erroneous. They probably believed he was al-Qaeda, but that doesn't excuse sending him to a country like Syria. He was a Canadian citizen. They were going to deport him anywhere. Legally speaking, he should have been sent back to Canada. And no one with a straight face who knows about these things can tell you that if you send someone to Syria, they're not going to get tortured. So they knew full well what was going to happen here. So the key issue is how could they make that decision? And why were they choosing to have his interrogation take place in Syria? Regardless of what they believed at the time.
Well, I
agree with that.
We will link on our website to the unusual interaction between the new chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Patrick Leahy, questioning Alberto Gonzalez, the attorney general, where he asked him that very question in very heated fashion. How could you send him to a place that your own government has said is responsible for torture? And Alberto Gonzalez said something along the lines of, we had assurances. I want to thank you, Stephen Gray, award-winning investigative journalist. His book is called Ghost Plane, and Frederick Hitz, former Inspector General at the Central Intelligence Agency, now professor at University of Virginia School of Law. We will follow the developments. This is Democracy Now. Stay with us.
I want to break free.
I want to break free, Queen, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Venezuelan president, Hugo Chavez, announced Thursday his government will move toward nationalizing major parts of the country's oil industry. Beginning on May 1st, Chavez said the government will take majority control of oil projects in the Orinoco River Basin. The move will affect several major international oil companies, including Chevron, ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips, and BP. The announcement came just one day after the Venezuelan National Assembly agreed to Chavez's request that he be allowed to rule by decree for the next 18 months. The legislation will allow Chavez to transform 11 areas, including the economy and defense. Since being reelected in December with 63% of the vote, Chavez has put forward a series of sweeping reforms that will lay the groundwork for what he describes as Bolivarian socialism. Chavez says that with this added authority, he'll also plan to nationalize Venezuela's largest telecommunications company and the electricity sector. Critics of the measure say it gives Chavez far too much authority. They predict that nationalizing Venezuela's industries will ultimately stunt Venezuela's economic growth. President Bush told Fox News earlier this week, quote, "I'm concerned about the undermining of democratic institutions, and we're working to help prevent that from happening." To discuss the situation in Venezuela, we turn to two guests. James Petras is professor emeritus of sociology and Latin American studies at SUNY Binghamton, author of the book Social Movements and State Power. Francisco Rodriguez is assistant professor of economics and Latin American studies at Wesleyan University and the former chief economist of the Venezuelan National Assembly. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin in the studio in Hartford with Francisco Rodriguez. Your concerns right now about the move, the National Assembly granting Chavez the power to rule by decree?
Well, I think that what's happening in Venezuela is that President Chavez has increased the scope of power and has increased the concentration of power in his person. And it's a gradual process that we've seen happening over the past few years, where the Supreme Court is under the control of his followers. The Assembly is 100%. All of the members of the Assembly are backers of President Chavez. The Electoral Council is very clearly stacked with his followers. The former president of the Electoral Council, who supervised the 2004 vote count, is now his vice president. And this is just one more step in which the president is concentrating power. He doesn't really even trust this Assembly, even though it's filled with his backers, and he wants to be able to legislate directly. Now, this figure of enabling law, the law that enables the president to rule by decree, has been used previously in Venezuela, but in the past it used to be very well circumscribed to specific areas of legislation, such as during the debt crisis the president was granted authority to legislate on particular economic issues. But now what we're seeing is an enabling law that will allow President Chavez to rule by decree in just about every area of the Venezuelan economy and society. It's couched in very vague terms such as social and economic rights, transforming state institutions. For the first time in history, President will have the right to rewrite organic laws, which are laws of constitutional rank, which generally would take a two-thirds majority in the Assembly to change them. But now he'll be allowed to do that by decree. So we are seeing a lot of power put in the hands of the president, and we're seeing something very close to the end of any type of separation of power in Venezuela.
Professor James Petras, your response.
These measures, as was mentioned, have a precedent in the past because there's a great deal of gridlock in the legislative process. Many of the assembly members, though formerly Chavistas, run the gamut from Christian Democrats, social Democrats, leftists, and all sorts of other variants. So I think what he's doing is what a lot of presidents do, is asking and securing fast-track powers to push through an agenda. It's not very different from what U.S. presidents have done in the past, is seek extra powers to deal with emergencies or opportunities to bring about significant changes. I think this is important also because his social programs have advanced enormously in terms of reduction of prices for consumers in low-income neighborhoods, the vast expansion of the health system, etc. And I think what the people are demanding is that these social measures be accompanied by structural changes, which give Venezuela effective control. Now, if you look at the specific measures, the 60% share of the oil industry, These are joint ventures, and I think it needs to be emphasized that the model of 21st century socialism that Chavez has outlined is simply in line with a mixed economy. Nationalizing the electric power is not something unusual because it allows the government to lower costs for downstream enterprises, and I think the telecommunications also is a factor in spurring new investments and profits downstream. I think, again, this business about concentrating power, let's not forget that Chavez was elected with 63% of the electorate. He has a mandate, and this, to me, is a kind of plebiscite to him to get on with structural changes and not merely welfare measures.
But, Professor Petras, why does he have to rule by decree? If he has that kind of support and that kind of support in the legislature, why not just have them vote on these issues that they would support?
As I mentioned, Amy, the legislature is formally Chavista, but they have proved really incompetent or dilatory in carrying out programs and implementing them. I could mention a host of areas where Congress has lagged behind, for instance, job creation programs, house building, etc. Chavez lays out a legislative agenda, and the people are very supportive of it, the electorate, as is demonstrated, and yet the Congress, even the Chavez Congress, has not been an effective instrument for carrying out these policies. I draw your attention to, in a different context, the demand by Presidents Clinton, Bush, and whoever for fast-track powers to negotiate huge trade agreements. And that's because they recognize that special interests and congressional delays can undermine the entire project and destroy public confidence in the elected officials.
Francisco Rodriguez, your response.
Well, I think that it's very strange to me to talk about gridlock in an assembly where every single member is a Chavista, where there is not one member who is a representative of the opposition. Well, I do think that there is.
They boycotted the election, is that right?
No, that's right. They boycotted the election. I'm just saying that talking about gridlock in that type of assembly where there's not even one member of the opposition seems to me to be somewhat strange. Now, they boycotted the election because the electoral council that was counting the votes was, among others, headed by Mr. Jorge Rodriguez, who's now the vice president of President Chavez, and they're a very close supporter and ally. Now, I think that the fundamental question here is whether there is a value to the separation of powers. Why do we believe that the legislative power should be separated from the judicial power and should be separated from the executive power? Because we believe that even though a president might be able to win an election with a very large number of votes, which, by the way, there are many interpretations of why that happens. Venezuela is also riding an economic boom, an expansion caused by an expansion, a fivefold expansion in oil prices. Under favorable economic conditions, presidents get reelected without that necessarily meaning that there's a mandate to construct a socialist society. But if we think that there is some value to the separation of powers, then we should be very wary about presidents taking authority, which is commonly in the sphere of legislative power. Now, I would just like to point out that with respect to the success of the social programs that Professor Petras points to, it's actually very hard to tell how successful these programs have been, and there's very little serious research that has been done on the subject. There's a lot of government propaganda. So the government claims that it taught 1.5 million people how to read and write, but there's really very little way to verify that kind of claims. The research that my colleagues and I have done at Wesleyan and University of Berkeley and the Indian Development Fund have found that the claims of the government, at least with respect to a literacy program, have been completely overblown. Using the government's own household surveys, which have measures of illiteracy, we found almost no decline in illiteracy during the government's during the period during which the literacy program was applied. We've also seen that there has been an increase in the number of Venezuelan children who are under height and underweight. We've analyzed the structure of social spending.
Professor Rodriguez, I wanted to ask your thoughts on the nationalizing of the oil. I mean, you have here President Chavez taking on the most powerful corporations on earth, ExxonMobil, Chevron, et cetera.
Right. Well, actually, there I would not disagree with Professor Petras. I think that nationalizing oil industry, as it was done in the 70s in Venezuela under the government of Carlos Andrés Pérez, many governments have chosen to have national telecommunications industries, national electricity. So I don't think that really the crux of the issue lies there. Actually, Chavez is a very skillful political strategist, and I would entertain the hypothesis that probably he wants to get people talking about this because he knows that there are a lot more important things that are going on in Venezuela, which maybe they won't talk about if they're centered on the nationalizations. Here's what worries me. The Minister of Labor, in a January 12th interview in the national newspaper El Universal, said that they're working on legislation to include community and workers' council participation, not only in the decision, but in the profits of all private firms. That's something that I find very worrying. It worries me that the government is closing down the nation's oldest private TV station without any type of judicial process because it accuses it of having participated in the coup, even though there hasn't been a judicial process to prove that. It's being closed down and it's going to be replaced by a state-run TV station.
So I think we have to wrap up. Let's get a response from Professor Petras on that point of the closing of the TV station.
I think the professor has left out some contextual variables that are crucially important. The closing down or the termination of the license for the television station is related to the fact that the television station was urging on an armed, violent overthrow of the government, elected government of Venezuela back in 2002. This may be a little late in actually carrying out the law, but I don't know any democratic government in the world, Western Europe, North America, Latin America, or elsewhere, which allows...
Professor Petras, we're going to have to leave it there. Professors Petras and Rodriguez, I want to thank you both for being with us as we wrap the show. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Shreef Abdokadous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richener, Mate Lee Burek, Jen Utz, Anna Nagara, Anuradha Bhagwati, Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio, Miguel Nagara, engineers, our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.